interspaces.
An interdisciplinary podcast.
Welcome back to Interspaces, the science podcast of CIF, the Center for Interdisciplinary Research at Bielefeld University. Today with me are the conveners of our new research group, a research group on robust decision heuristics for natural and artificial intelligence. This group is working at CIF from September 25 to August 28. Maybe we start by a little introduction round. Could you please introduce yourself?
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm Özgür Şimşek. I'm a professor of AI at the University of Bath in the UK.
Hi, yeah. I'm Gerd Gegerinzer, long-term director at the Max Planck Institute for Human Development, and I'm interested in how people make decisions under uncertainty, that is, when we don't know the future and when optimization is of little help.
Hi, my name is Mohan Sridharan. I'm a professor of robot systems at the University of Edinburgh in the UK, and I'm interested in cognition and control in humans and machines.
Yeah, thanks a lot. So humans, machines, and I learned from the website also insects, they all have to make decisions, and that's not always easy. So maybe we start with a little conceptual question. What is a robust decision heuristic?
Okay, a heuristic is a rule that is typically simple, fast to execute, and it is what people do under uncertainty in order to avoid the downsides of trying to use too complex rules, which are known as overfitting, and also it's just not very effective. And a robust decision rule is one that works in many possible futures. So all of this is meant for situations where we, where the typical tools like expected utility maximization, Bayesian updating, do not apply because the state space is not known.
You mentioned it's a heuristic. So that's not an algorithm, it's a heuristic.
It is an algorithm. Okay. There is no different. So they're just a simple algorithms.
Okay.
And we also, one important distinction to what's often called heuristics, say in the Kahneman and Tversky program, where heuristics are just one word, like representativeness or availability, and you never know what it means.
So from computer science, I know the distinction in between algorithms as describing a procedure where you can be sure to get a result and heuristics as a procedure where you are not, where you cannot know if you will really get a result.
But look, in most interesting problem, be it in machine learning or in the real ordinary world of people, there is no way to find the optimal solution. We have to satisfy. So that's a term by Herbert Simon. And to find a good enough solution that is actually can be practiced.
I think maybe I'm going to shamelessly steal something that we have discussed today and from what Gerd has written and done, right? So he gives very good examples in the books that he has written, and also Oscar has written stuff with Gerd as well. So I'll ask you this question. What does the word heuristic bring in your head? What do you visualize? What do you think of a heuristic? No, just what does that word mean to you? What are you thinking? Because when you were asking the question, you were saying that the description just now, you were saying that heuristic might be an algorithm and you may not be sure of the result and stuff. In fact, heuristic is an algorithmic process, the way we understand this, that is used when you don't have enough information to use some of these more sophisticated or complex machines or methods that will actually require you to have complete knowledge, right? And they require you to have, they don't really deal with uncertainty, where the space of possibilities is not known, right? If anything, decision heuristics and the robust decision heuristics we are talking about here will help you solve problems that these other methods cannot solve. Right? They're not less powerful. Actually, our claim is they are more powerful. They can solve the kind of problems that these other methods cannot. Right? Okay. Just that to, on first view, they might look simpler. They might look as if, like, you know, this will not work. But they do have a strong algorithmic basis, that there is a maths to it, mathematics to it, and there is also a method to it. It's not just something that you cook up, for instance. That's one way in the AI literature. Sometimes heuristics are thought of as hacks, things that you do because you can't do anything else. That is not what we are talking about.
Okay.
So maybe an example. Do you play baseball?
No.
Cricket?
No, not really.
Soccer?
I drive bicycle.
That's good, yeah. But assume, yeah? So there's an experienced baseball outfielder, and a ball comes in high, and it's up there, and an experienced outfielder knows where to run in order to catch the ball. How does he or she do it? Now, there are two ways to think about this. One, it's a kind of optimal control problem, and the outfielder somehow estimates the trajectory of the ball and runs to the point where it's coming down. That's the typical way to think. Yeah, of course, studies show that's not what I do. And actually, the problem is not computation, it's estimation of all the parameters you would have to somehow get right in order to know where the ball is coming down. Experimental studies show that baseball outfielders use a simple heuristic, actually a few. The simplest one is, if the ball is already high up in the air, the outfielder fixes the ball with the eye and starts running and keeps the running speed, adjusts the running speed so that the angle of gaze remains constant. And then you can see the player will be there where the ball is coming down. This is a heuristic. And it's an interesting one because it relies on a single cue, the angle of gaze. And it's a constant monitoring and changing over time, but a single cue. And it can ignore all the variables that you need to calculate when you would do a trajectory calculation. That's an example. And it also illustrates there is nothing else to do. And the only question is which heuristic to use in which situation in order to solve real-world problems.
Perhaps I'll also use this opportunity, and maybe because she remembered that example when we were writing this. The cool thing about this heuristic is not just that it's for baseball, is that this may seem like a game, but the same heuristic is also can be used directly without any change for much more complex problems.
Yeah, to give another example, for example, you may remember, I don't know, maybe in 2009, there was the incident of the miracle on the Hudson. So a plane, a commercial passenger plane, left, I believe, LaGuardia Airport. And within 2 minutes, they were struck by a flock of geese. Yeah. And I believe both engines were disabled. And at that moment, very quickly, the captain and the co-captain have to make a decision what to do. And one of the first decisions that they had to do was, are they able to go back to LaGuardia and land safely? And the co-captain, Jeffrey Skiles, explains how they made this decision as follows. So the question is whether the plane is going to make it or is it going to fall short. So when they are trying to land the plane in that way, they're looking at their destination and they're looking at this desired destination, LaGuardia Airport runway, whether it's rising in the windshield, whether it's descending on the windshield or staying constant. If it's staying constant, they will make it. If it's rising, they're going to fall short. And if it's descending, they're going to overpass it. So by employing this particular heuristic, they decided that they are not going to make it. And that's how they decided to land on the Hudson River. So that was the exact mechanism they used to make this high-stakes decision in a very short amount of time. And it's the same principle as the one that Gerd just spoke about, which we call the gaze heuristic. The basic principle is this is the same. And we see the same principle in all kinds of shapes, in different animals.
Even robots.
Robots and humans in different circumstances and animals in different circumstances. It just shows up in different guises. But it's the same principle.
That would have been my next question. You mentioned a mechanism that sounds like it should be possible to realize it in an artificial system or even
exactly.
in a robot. So is that the idea, the basic idea of the research group, that you look for these kind of heuristics or mechanisms or algorithms in natural systems and try to learn from this for implementing them in artificial systems?
Yeah, so we have multiple goals, I would say. The first one, we really are working on the science of heuristic decision making. So we are understanding and developing principles for heuristic decision making. Some of these could be applied in artificial intelligence systems. We try to understand how people make decisions using heuristics. We also try to bring methodologies and different principles from AI and machine learning into the understanding of cognitive systems and how humans and animals make decisions. It's a two-way. We try to understand natural intelligence and artificial intelligence at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interdisciplinary group that we have here together. And I don't know, maybe Mohan can give some examples of the use of the gaze heuristics in robotics.
Okay, so let me give you a very simple example. Imagine, I don't know if you've seen, but imagine robots playing soccer.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We have done stuff with four-legged dog-like robots and two-legged humanoid-like robots. And so when you're doing it, you have to do multiple things. You have to track where the ball is. You have to track where the opponent is. And now if you track where the ball is and chase after the ball, then you will start playing soccer like kids do, right? They all go to the same point and nothing ever happens, right? But instead, what we found to be very easy to do, or the best way to do this, was for each robot, instead of doing something very sophisticated, is to just see where the ball is, right? And then because your perception can change, you might see part of the ball, it might be occluded, and then you might start thinking it is suddenly much far away. Instead, maintain a certain angle. And like, you know, for instance, if there is a goalkeeper, the goalkeeper is going to maintain a certain angle to the ball. Now, irrespective of how far or close it is, if the person shoots, it's going to come at a certain angle, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that, again, is maintaining the angle, which is similar to what Gerd and Oscar were saying about, like, you know, using that as a way to do things, right? Of course, there are more complex ways to do things, but then those are dependent on parameters which are more susceptible to this noise and this uncertainty that we've been talking
mm-hmm.
about.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, if you do a simple strategy, right, I will again say seemingly simple strategy, because simple things are not easy to arrive at. You have to think hard to find these simple strategies. But once you use them in the right place, then what you can get is you can get much more robust performance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Performance that stays reliable and computationally efficient, despite this kind of open world uncertainty, things that can change in many different ways.
Mm-hmm. So the idea is that there are some principles which can be found, which apply to artificial systems, but also to natural systems, to humans and animals.
And like Oscar was saying, it is like, you know, this bidirectional flow. Use your understanding of natural systems, whether they are humans or insects, and use them to build robust methods for artificial systems,
mm-hmm.
and use artificial systems as the means to maybe test and discover and improve theories that you have of cognition in natural systems.
Mm-hmm. So when your artificial soccer player falls over, then you know that maybe your theory on his heuristics were not perfect.
I don't think so. When it falls over, it also has a method to get up, so it's all good.
Okay.
I wouldn't go as far as saying the theory was bad. I would just say that, like, you know, and that's the important point again, and something that Gerd also mentioned before. It's not that it has to be always correct, right? The intention is to say we want a system that can adapt and that can deal with previously unknown or unseen situations. And that is where the strength lies, right? Not when everything is well defined, especially
mm-hmm.
these days. I don't know if you are going to come to that. With these large systems being built for AI problems, the key thing is they work well when the space is somewhat well defined. And decision heuristics, the strength lies when that is exactly not true. And that is what we see. The kind of problems we see in the practical world are often cases where you have to deal with situations that you've not seen before.
So, I mean, we see now the large language models you mentioned. And, a layperson could think that it should be easy to connect a large language model to a robot. And then you have a robot which is at least as intelligent as the large language model. And ChatGPT has always reported that it can pass exams for elite universities and all this stuff. And then you have an elite intelligent robot. But it's not that simple. So where's the problem for the robot?
I can start and maybe others can fix things where I don't say things. So if you take the large language model, let us first take a step back. What do they do, right? They are essentially statistical predictors, right? So if you imagine it, let me break it down, right? If I ask you, if I give you the sentence, where are you? And I ask you to sell the next word, you're going to say, okay, where are you going maybe, or something like that, right? So this is based on you having some prior statistics of what is the most likely next word, right? Now, what has happened is it started with language of saying, if I had a large block of prior text, can I predict the next word that is likely to come? Now, this notion of word has been extended to this notion of a token, because it can be language, as in words, it can be images, it can be other different forms as well. So that is why they are called multimodal models, right? That is, they can be language, they can be images, and so on. But in essence, the technology remains the same, right? Get some prior to predict what comes next, right? So now, yes, they can do seemingly impressive things, but the kind of examples you gave, like doing tests and other things well, what is often not observed is that it is still a very well-defined problem, right? And now, at the same time, if you take, because I'm talking about robotics, there are researchers who have tried the following. They've said, I'll give you problems where I introduce a new situation that you've never seen before, right? So if you're, say, stacking blocks up and stuff, I give you a problem where there is no obvious solution. Or I give you some new kind of things, like a sphere or something that you've never seen before, right? And now, unless you truly understand what the problem is about, or unless you have ways of reasoning with these previously unseen situations, they fail massively, even for seemingly tasks on a tabletop, right? That is one. Now, the second one is, because they are statistical predictors, right? They lack consistency. They lack reliability that they may, given the same situation, they are just predictors. They can predict something else. And they also lack any sense of transparency. If you really want to know why a particular decision was made, and I've already expressed my frustration in our discussions, if you wanted to know why your credit score is a particular way, or why your credit card limits cannot be increased, we don't have answers, because these are all these large estimator systems that don't provide any kind of knowledge or understanding of what's going on. So that is why, though they are very impressive, like as a roboticist, I use them for specific problems, like if I want to recognize objects, or if I want to learn something where the space of possibilities is well defined. But if it's truly open, and we come back to that, all of us, then in those situations, they are not necessarily the best methods to use for those problems, right?
Perhaps I can add a few things. So we don't see it as large language models versus heuristics. It's not this competitive situation. I think they both have their niche. So there are situations, large language models are very, very successful, unexpectedly successful, surprisingly successful. They delight us in certain things, and we love them for that. But they are not, so they do have their limitations, and they are not applicable in every situation. And similarly, heuristics, they have their particular niches as well. So we can think of a lot of hybrid systems where you use deep neural networks, but you also use heuristics, and you combine them together. In fact, Mohan is doing some of this in the robotics soccer football teams that he's assembling together.
Yeah. So the idea is not that you only orient yourself towards natural heuristics, which you copy, so to say, from natural systems to artificial systems, but you would also say, okay, we can also use large language models which function in a very different way than humans think, but it's also okay to use ways which are not copied from nature, so to say.
Of course, yes. And probably this is also a good time to come back to this, because it's come up in our discussions. The basic notion of robustness is exactly that, right? You entertain multiple fail-safe systems that you have, like, you know, different ways of controlling the system. You have modularity. You have, like, you know, decoupling of different processes, so that if there is any failure, you can quickly limit it, and you have other ways of recovering from it. So that's why it goes back to what Oscar was saying, this notion of hybrid systems that entertain or keep multiple different ways of doing things. But a really smart system should be able to use them at the right time and choose this, make this choice, make decisions automatically. Right? And last bit, just, we are not copying from natural systems. We are using our understanding of natural systems to develop methods. Right?
So you are using the theory of bounded rationality from Herbert Simon, as I took from your abstract. So there, during the last year, there had been a lot of discussion on perfect rationality and minimal rationality. And could you say something about what is bounded rationality?
Herbert Simon's notion of bounded rationality meant how to study how actual people or institutions or animals make decisions. That's the first thing. As opposed to ask if expected utility maximization models. So find me the CEO in our world who uses expected utility maximization. I have not found one. It's an as-if model that's maintained because one has certain preferences for mathematical model, not because it corresponds to reality, and also not, there's no evidence, according to some studies, that it predicts actually, nor that it is normative. It's maintained, and I would say, because of a belief system. Just like at Ptolemy's time, people believed that the heavenly bodies have to move in circles. And then it didn't predict well. You have epicircles. Today, much of the social scientists, particularly economists, believe that one has to have a model where everything can be reduced to an optimization. That was what Herbert Simon was arguing against at the first point. So make models of satisfying, not optimization. And that also meant study how actual animals, humans, institutions, make decisions. If you believe in optimization model, you can't really study the reality because it's different. And finally, Herbert Simon was asking study situations which he would call uncertainty. So where we do not know the state space, where we do not know all the things that can happen in the future, and we cannot do a Bayesian probability distribution on that and revise it. So, and that's in the most situation, investment, what things happen. So the first time open heart surgery, what probabilities, what can happen? And these situations are very typical. Find the best partner for your life. Good luck. If you won't do that, there are too many. And you cannot even find the best T-shirt. You could do this maybe 50 years ago when a shop had 5 T-shirts. You could check everyone and all they mentioned and find the best one. But now there are online shops who have 5 million T-shirts. So that forces you to do heuristic decision-making. So Simon meant dare to study uncertainty, as opposed to what's called calculable risk, also often called Knightian uncertainty, but often misunderstood that you could have still probabilities on that. And study how people actually make decisions rather than they behave as if they would maximize something. And also study the adaptation of heuristics to the environment. So, for instance, the gaze heuristic works if the ball is high up there. If a ball comes directly at you, like in ping pong, it doesn't help you. So, and the heuristics are fitted to the environment, and that's why they can be so good. So that's the Simonian program. And he called this bounded rationality, but the term has been hijacked twice. So economists have misused it as optimization under constraint. That's the typical thing. Herbert Simon once told me in private conversation that he wanted to sue these economists who misuse his term for optimization again. And then there's another group, that's psychologists around Kahneman, Tversky, who have also hijacked the term for the opposite of optimization and constraint, for deviations from optimization. So that's known as the biases, cognitive biases program. Simon was always clear, bounded rationality is not irrationality. But he was too revolutionary for his time, because demanding the study of behavior in real uncertain situation without saying, okay, this is a model of the market, and the market, now here's the model, and then everything is certain suddenly. So we'll try to continue that and flesh out Simon's model. By the way, Reinhard Selten, who was again a guest here, he knew very well that part of his work, it's about game theory, And these are highly restricted, closed world, where you exactly know what can happen and what cannot happen. And he loved this because he was a mathematician, but his heart was in something different, studying how people actually make decision-making. And we did a book together. But the dominant view is still optimization. People need to optimize something. Whatever you do, you have optimized some utility. Mm-hmm. We want to get out of that and actually see the messy world and the intelligent heuristics that animals, humans, institutions use to cope with this work.
So you are talking about very different kinds of decisions, I think. So there are decisions where to run when you see a ball coming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's somewhat different from deciding which T-shirt to buy or whom to marry or
yeah.
which job to apply for or to have a problem in science where you have to decide which theory you prefer for what reasons. So do you have a kind of catalog of different heuristics for different kinds
yeah.
of problems or how to imagine?
The common denominator is there's uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Uncertainty, and not just that you don't know the probabilities, but you don't know the consequences of your actions.
Mm-hmm.
Precisely, you cannot list all of them. And heuristics that people use, they start from, so we are looking for principles, like ordering. A decision tree that has an order, a regular decision tree has no order and gets quickly very, very complex. And order is a principle that you can put in and people go by order to make it simple and efficient that you can actually do it. Or another principle is equality. So invest equally. So here's a nice story to get the difference between optimization and heuristics. Harry Markowitz, who got his Nobel Prize in economics for an investment strategy. That's the mean variance portfolio. And when he made his own investment, so put in his own money for the time after his retirement, we might think he used his optimization, Nobel Prize winning strategy. No. He did not. He used a simple heuristic that's called 1 over N. So if you have choice, maybe two assets to invest, 50-50. Three, a third, a third, a third. And N is the number of. And the interesting thing is, this is a heuristic. It's an extreme heuristic. It doesn't use any data. It's the opposite of big data. While Markowitz's Nobel Prize winning strategy needs tons of data to estimate all these parameters. And quite a number of studies show that there are situations where 1 over N makes more money than the Nobel Prize winning strategy. And what this situation is, that's our question. That's what we call ecological rationality, because no strategy, no heuristic, and also no Nobel Prize winning strategy works everywhere.
Perhaps we can add some detail that may be useful for listeners. So the Nobel Prize winning strategy assumes certain structures in the world and makes assumptions about the parameters that you have enough data to estimate these parameters. So these are very nice mathematical assumptions in theory, and it gives you this beautiful optimization answer. However, when we actually look at investment in the real world, the basic assumptions are violated. And when the basic assumptions are violated, the optimality in the small world, in the hypothetical, theoretical world, does not transfer well to the real world, which is messy. So that's the distinction. So we are in this group are interested in developing principles of decision making that we can use in the messy reality of the real world, be it for human beings, animals, or artificial agents.
Mm-hmm. So humans somehow know which heuristic to use generally. But in artificial intelligence, there's this hype on artificial agents, which should be allowed to take more and more autonomous decisions. So there's a kind of, pressure to come up with heuristics now for them to decide in a reliable and secure and transparent way. Is your research also going in this direction?
Well, I'm going to address one of it very directly. So transparency is obviously a very important topic when it comes to artificial decision making. And decision heuristics, almost by definition, because they are so simple, they are transparent. So, for example, if you think about the decisions that heuristics that we've discussed so far, in each one of those cases, we can explain to you why that specific decision was taken. So the investment decision, why are you investing in this way? Because I'm investing equally on all of the options. It's 1 over N. Why did you decide not to land on the LaGuardia Airport? It's not a yes-no answer that came from a black box of a neural network. It came from the pilot and co-pilot can describe exactly why they made that decision, and we can understand why they made that decision. So transparency is a big thing. It's an artifact of because they have this simple structure, they tend to be very easy to understand and very easy to explain, easy to memorize, and at the time of the decision, easy to implement. Mm-hmm.
Does it mean we will get reliable artificial agents? So
that's
would you give your credit card to an artificial agent?
That's the goal. That's what we are working towards.
Mm-hmm. And even if the same technique, once again, just as a quick example, like, you know, in one of their books, they write about using this kind of simple decision tree, which is called a fast and frugal tree, which is another kind of heuristic, decision heuristic. They use that to describe how, say, a doctor or a surgeon makes a decision in order to determine who gets, like, you know, if they have some heart ailment or they're likely to have it, who gets to be admitted in the ICU and who doesn't, right? These are practical problems, right? And by design, going back to what Oscar was saying, they provide process level descriptions, right? They tell you what is the process that's being followed. That's what they capture in that very design. And now you can take the same fast and frugal tree and apply it for a wide range of applications, right? And in multiple cases, again, the common factor is the presence of uncertainty, true uncertainty, which means that you don't know the space of possibilities. And I'll give you a trivial example. We have used it with robots that are just predicting what the other robot will do so they can collaborate with them better. Right? Again, same decision heuristic, just applied elsewhere, right? And so that's what is very appealing, is that they easily go across domains, across problems, if you understand what their characteristics are, and if you understand where to use which decision heuristic. And that is what goes back to what Oscar was saying. That's what we're going to try and document is the science of decision heuristics, right? Is to figure out the mathematical principles are very clear to the person, say, reading what we write, and then they are able to make the same choice for themselves and figure out which application, which class, or which type of decision heuristic is best suited for.
Mm-hmm. So you have, so to say, a meta level, you have the decision heuristic, and or you have a lot of decision heuristics, and then you have the question which one to use in which situation.
Yeah, and I'm going to quote freely from what Gerd writes in his papers as well. It's like, think of this as a toolbox. There are these different buckets of possible heuristics. If you can match the characteristics of the heuristics to the characteristics of the problem, then you have the right choice.
And part of this group here is to learn from one another. So I just learned a few days ago from Mohan that he is using a certain heuristic for making soccer robots smarter that is used in a total different context. So I give you an example. Have you ever had a desire to climb Mount Everest?
Not really.
Not really, yeah. There are some people. So a group of six climbers, including a doctor and a decision researcher, not just wanted to get up, they wanted to get up from the Kangchung phase, which very few teams have ever tried and very few got up and alive back.
It's the east phase, which is the toughest. So, yeah.
And the example also illustrates that the heuristics are combined with other things that we call, for instance, plans. And these guys made a plan. The plan included how much oxygen, what materials, who calls the shots, and all these things. And they trained for 2 years to be physically to this task because they had, this is more than 1,000 meters, basically a vertical wall they had to get up. So, and then unexpected things happened. That's the uncertainty part, huh? Because they couldn't know. And they were surprised when they were on the wall that the amount of stones and ice that came down was just unbelievable. And their plan was when that they would make the decision on the wall where to go next together. But they found out, if we do this and deliberate there, well, probably soon dead. So then they, in the tent at night, then they talked about and changed the plan and developed a heuristic. The heuristic was the first climber on the rope calls the shots and the others just accept. So no deliberation anymore. It's for safety. And that's what they did. And the interesting thing is, this is a version of follow the leader, a more general heuristic, but the leader is always a different one every day. So it also kind of democratic heuristic. So when I told Mohan that story, and by the way, they made it and down. It took him 41 days.
Even wrote a paper.
Yeah, wrote a paper on the heuristics they had used. And when I told Mohan about this, he told me, oh, I'm using the same heuristic for the soccer robots. So as I understand, and so the robots find out where the ball is, and then the one who is closest sends a signal to the others, I call the shots, I will go after the ball, and you guys go after the others. So that we prevent that, what you see in children, they're all going to the ball. So they follow the leader. This type of heuristic is also useful to organize the interaction between robots.
Great, yeah. Great that it works. Though there's often the critique that AI systems and also robots don't work properly because in the end they miss something called common sense. And that this common sense knowledge is somehow connected with a body, with embodiment, and all these things you will never get into a technical system, at least if you do not allow it to have a childhood and everything. And so is it true, or what do you think?
I would probably push back a bit on that system. If anything, I would say that where do these heuristics come from, right? To me, at least as a robotics person, the appeal is that in some sense, they do capture the common sense. That's what they do. The common sense knowledge that humans might have, that is what these heuristics are trying to capture, right? Mm-hmm. So, and the other thing also is that even without this, like, you know, if you look historically, there has been a lot of research on trying to say, like, you know, how do I understand common sense? How do I sort of encode it? How do I reason with it? They've tried different ways. And even, say, for the work that I do and other robotics researchers do, if you take these kind of decision heuristics and going back to the points that were made before and use them in conjunction with the other systems that are there, you do come up with systems, if you want to call them hybrid systems, that are better able to use prior common sense knowledge that you might have and to use that to get you out of situations. Because when do you fail? You fail because you're not anticipated something or you make a mistake and stuff like that, right? And that's exactly those kind of situations where having some kind of decision heuristics would help you, right, as a way to... And again, goes back to robustness. What does it mean? It means having different ways of doing things, different alternative mechanisms. And so I would say that maybe currently we don't have robots or agents that can do that, but that is not because there is no way to do it. We are, and other people are working on it. And if anything, I have more promise or more, I hold more promise for systems that use decision heuristics rather than these large, huge models, which they give different names, foundational, generative. These are exactly the names that they are not suitable for because that's not what they do.
Mm-hmm. This is why we also use the term psychological
Yes.
AI,
yeah.
Which sounds like a contradiction. But the idea is, can we find principles that we know the human mind has evolved or learned, and that might be helpful for designing better AI systems? That's the question. While most of machine learning is just thinking in statistical terms.
Mm-hmm.
And the other question of our program is even more challenging. Now, if you understand better how AI systems use heuristics, can we learn something about the human mind? How? As it is, or how it could be improved.
Mm-hmm. So, you are a psychologist, so maybe for you the perspective is more, I don't know, a neural than to look from humans to artificial agents than the other way around. So, the idea that you can learn something about human decision making by building artificial agents, is it a how did you learn about this perspective, and how did you? Oh, somehow you thought that it might be worse to spend the time with artificial agents to learn something more about psychology. So as a psychologist, you became interested in artificial agents. What do you think can you learn for psychology from artificial agents?
I have a request before Gert says. You should also tell them about the mind as a computer and other things. We have learned more about AI systems, right? And then as we have done that, we've been able to provide better structure for studying psychology and other things. That's my request. Now you can.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So the reverse one. So what I say is the much more difficult answer. Yeah? So psychological AI goes in one direction. How can we help AI to get better by using a human principle like forgetting, making things simpler, heuristics, and other things? Huh? The reverse one, the making conclusions from AI on the human mind, that Herbert Simon has done that. And he had argued the mind as a computer. Basically arguing the physical symbol hypothesis, that was his term, that it's the same, basically. Yeah? The mind is organized hierarchical, the computer. How he was thinking about the conventional computer. And in a system like that, and actually the history is even more interesting, if you allow me, culture. So it's one of the cases where the social sciences were the inspiration for, in this case, building computers. So precisely, after the French Revolution, there was an engineer, Prony, who designed a human computer to recalculate the logarithms. Because of one important part of the French Revolution was to change to the digital system that some countries have not, even in the Western world, still not reached. And what he did is he made a pyramid, a hierarchy system. There were two top mathematicians. Legendre was one of them. Then about 10 or so people who could do math. But on the bottom, 80 or 90 people who just could add and subtract. And this human computer calculated the logarithms to an unprecedented precision. Now, Charles Babbage, knew about this system and also about the weaving systems that had punch cards. And his reasoning was, uneducated humans can do it, then a machine can do it. And this was his inspiration for building the first computers, more or less. And Babbage was known also as a factory tourist, going through the big factories were something amazing at this time. So here we have a case where a human system and computers were first people. Inspired the building of machines. And so this exchange between, call it the social sciences and the machine sciences, has been going on all the time.
I'll give one example, if I may. Because you mentioned insects and we have not said anything about it, I'm going to borrow from something that my colleague in Edinburgh does. So there's a professor there called Barbara Webb, and there are others who basically do the same thing with insects, right? So replace humans with insects and agents with robots, and then ask the following questions that can I use, going back to the question you were asking, what they're asking is, can I use robots to postulate and test theories that tell me about how insects do various tasks, right? And in doing so, they're trying to figure out, I joke with her that they have figured out that insects can do something like vector addition, go from point A to point B, point B to point C, and then be able to come back. Or also to make theories or test them about, say, and they build and actually test with small robots and insects, bees and ants, to see how do you navigate, how do you localize, how do you figure out where they are, how do you look at, and it goes back to some other heuristics, how do you figure out where to focus, and can you then develop better theories on how insects do variety of tasks, right? And there are very interesting results, right, both with humans and other biological organisms. And so that is what makes us feel very excited about this, is to be able to go in both directions like this.
So did you learn anything about humans from machines, from artificial systems?
Now, as I said, that's a more difficult thing. Yeah? And that's our second goal. And the Mohan has just given some hint about insects, that they might do something similar like robots, like vector addition. And I'm very curious about the outcome of these years here at the CIF, and I've been here, spent two full years in earlier time, and I must say this is an excellent and a unique institution for developing together in this place and in Bielefeld where, sorry, there's not much else to do.
That's our secret, which is not making people work.
Which is a superpower. Which is a superpower.
That's our superpower.
And just think and think.
Yeah.
And listen.
So how did you choose the fellows for your group? How did you choose from which field they should come to answer your question in the best way possible?
So are you talking about the conveners? That happened more organically because people knew each other and came in contact with each other, right? So, and I'll just say this and they can fill in more details, but like, you know, Gerd and Konstantinos and Oskar, they've worked with each other for, or known each other for many years. I am sort of the more newcomer, right? So I read about something that Gerd had done, and then also because of other people I know whom I work with. But I should say that it's not that it doesn't get the attention that it much deserves, right? Mm-hmm. In the AI robotics community. But then Gerd once gave, we invited him to give a talk in a conference I was organizing, and then I spent time reading, and then I made contact with Oskar and Konstantinos, and then we said we should try and develop this further, and then we talked, and Gerd was the person who suggested that ZIF here is a very good opportunity for us to do this, and we applied for that. In terms of other people, we specifically picked, and you may have seen the abstract and the application, we picked certain areas where we wanted to explore, be it like in economics, be it robotics, like, you know, with insects or otherwise, be it sort of like, you know, business decision making. And then that's how we assembled a set of people whom we then reached out and contacted, right?
And one principle is heterogeneity.
Yes.
So Oskar's background is machine learning. Mohan's is robotics. Now, Konstantinos is engineering. Mine is psychology. And if you have a common goal, then a good heuristic is attack it from as many different points of view as possible.
Mm-hmm. So how is your experience with the interdisciplinary collaboration? Is it easy? Is it difficult?
Well, it's fun. So people know different things, right? Mm-hmm. So I think as we discuss every day, you hear different perspectives, their questions are different, the knowledge they bring to the table is different. So there is an intellectual curiosity that we all naturally have, and that's quite nicely satisfied in this environment. So it's also quite different from each of our home environments. It tends to be more homogeneous. And so the opportunity that we have here, the first word I would characterize is fun. It's also at the same time challenging, because sometimes even the terminology is different between different fields. And especially initially, there's a lot of time spent simply explaining things, very basic things to each other. So that's just part of interdisciplinary collaboration. I will let my co-conveners add more to this, but the whole interdisciplinary aspect is something that we cherish. It's also, for the subject that we're studying, it's essential. No single discipline can resolve these problems. We need the different disciplines to come together.
I'll just add that if the goal, as we stated, is to flesh out and share the science of decision heuristics, then Oskar's point is absolutely correct. You cannot do so unless you bring different perspectives and different disciplines together. And I would also say that any such interdisciplinary collaboration, we may all have done stuff individually elsewhere with other things. Like, you know, for as a roboticist, I've worked with, say, agricultural engineers as something. I don't know much about agriculture, right? So in all these instances, the same thing, right? You need to understand each other's vocabulary. By that, I mean, we all speak English, but, like, you know, in terms of how we describe things, and it pushes you to be patient. It pushes you to sort of like, you know, take time to explain and do things with each other. But it's also extremely rewarding on the other side, right? In the sense that you learn a lot more and a lot deeper sense of like, you know, both understanding and satisfaction, which is, I think, what motivates all of us to engage in this exercise, right? It's both, right? Very challenging, but also very rewarding.
I spent my life as a former Max Planck director, always in interdisciplinary group that I have tried to create myself, and by purpose, because I didn't want to end up as the person who knows everything that all the others know. By having an interdisciplinary group, I am always the learner. I'm always the child who actually every day learns something in addition. That's also next to the fun of that, that it just keeps your mind alive. Huh? And you never stop within your own small disciplines. And curiosity is such an important value.
Yeah, that's true. So for your group, you choose the long-term group format. That means you will not spend the whole time till August 28 at CIF, but you will come back again and again. So how are you going to proceed? What are your plans for the next future?
So currently, our current plan, and this may, of course, change, right, is to come at least 2 times a year, right? Like, you know, roughly 6 months apart, maybe in the summer, maybe in the winter. But I think we have a good group, and that is nice. I mean, we have built a kind of relationship here that's strong. So our hope and plan is to therefore say that we will have specific objectives for each time that we meet. But there are also these things that will lead to tasks that we continue when we go away as well, right? As an example, say we are planning to try and write a book, right? If that is the case, then the basic outline and the other things are worked out here, and then say tasks are assigned, and then we take this with us, work on this, come back. Right? At the same time, we also have plans to bring other people in, like we talked about just for the previous question, and that will also further push us in different directions, help extend our learning and understanding. And so I think it is a good format, right? For each of us, at least for those of us in academic institutions, it's hard to sort of come away and spend the entire time here. This gives us a chance both to meet and have this nice deep conversations, but also come up with tasks that we take and work on during the, say, the break that we get, 6 month break, if I can characterize it that way, when we work on things and then come back to our normal job here, which is to work on things together.
Maybe one day you could bring your football robots.
I'm happy to try next time. Let's see.
So how robust will artificial systems be in, let's say, 10 years?
Oh, anyone's guess.
Five years. I don't know what is a realistic guess.
So AI is moving very fast. Yeah. And I will question anyone who claims to predict the future of AI. I think there is broad agreement that the current systems, despite their very pleasantly surprising performance in certain tasks, we are far from. There are still a few missing pieces, right? That's, I think there is generally agreement in the field about that. We have not solved the problem of intelligence. And so there is a few critical pieces missing, at least, and it's anyone's guess when they're going to be resolved. It could be next week. It could be 5 years from now.
Next week.
So I don't think we can speculate about the future in terms of the algorithmic developments. I think something that's been very pleasant is that we have attention right now, and more people are getting interested in the world of intelligence. So maybe we can recruit more people into the field and bring different. It's not only, in fact, people are now thinking about machine learning and AI coming from different dimensions, from different scientific disciplines, right? And all of that, I think, is going to enrich AI as a field. So I do have a lot. I personally very, very much look forward to what's going to happen in the field in the next few years, but I don't wish to speculate on it. I think it'll be exciting.
So I will, if I may go out on a limb, I don't know, you're recording this, maybe I'll come to regret it later, but I'll say it anyway. So if we truly want to develop these kind of intelligent agents, right, if that's the goal, what I think, and I will make this as a hypothesis maybe not as a statement, is that it's not going to happen just by using these large models and these sort of large systems that claim to be with different names, right, generative and whatnot, because they by themselves are not sufficient, right? And if we trust them and then use these systems, that's when the actual harms are going to happen. Not that the AI is going to take over the world. It's like our misuse, if I may say it that way, of these systems which are not suitable for these tasks based on these few impressive performances in specific well-defined tasks. If we use them, then we are to blame for any harm that comes, not the AI system, right? But in terms of the future, what I think is if we truly develop systems that, and we understand what their capabilities are, we understand what the limitations are, and as all of us have said in the last hour or so, is that if we can truly understand where the complementarity is, where they are good for, what they are not good for, and build systems that put them together, and if we use them in a proper way where they are should be used, then I think the outlook is very much positive that they may actually improve the quality of life for people around the world. But if we don't do that, I don't think we're going to achieve whatever the future holds, right? And we are not big tech companies. We have no vested interests or anything here. So from our viewpoint, I think if we truly want intelligent or AI systems of the future to actually be beneficial, then we should not depend on just the current buzzword or something, but develop these better systems that are truly robust. I'll stop there.
It is often said that the future of mankind will be rosy because of the development of AI. There will be super intelligence which let us upload our brains and so that we can even become immortal, you know, and finally stay forever around, or the other side, that the AI will destroy us like in some movies. I personally think this is none of this is the right position. If we should be worried, we should be worried about the people behind the AI. And that is the richest man, the old man on Earth, or the heads of countries like Putin, how they will use developments in robotics, for instance. And that should be the question. There is all kind of conferences on ethics in AI, how to make a large language model to behave more ethical. The conferences should have a different topic. How to protect us from the visions of an Elon Musk, a Zuckerberg, a Putin, a Xi, or many others of this powerful man. That should be the question. And on the your question, what can AI do and not? I agree with Oscar. We don't know. But one thing, just to throw in something, what I think is AI will progress the faster for tasks which have a stable world. And that's the history. Chess, Go. And well-defined systems, but even large language models, operate on a corpus of words in a language which is fairly stable. It may change in 50 years or so, and that's not. The problems will be when in uncertainty. So how to predict human behavior, for instance, which is typically, we are one of the major sources of uncertainty. And that will be the hard task to do. But as a consequence, to solve this, if the world is not stable, then one option is to make it stable. So an illustration is we don't have self-driving cars, level 5. We have level 4. And level 4 is a car without a backup driver that cannot drive everywhere. In Phoenix, it works. Yeah? But in a small Italian city, good luck. And the solution then would be that we have to adapt to rebuild the cities, that's one thing, and also do no longer allow humans behind the wheel. And then we can have level 4 automized driving if you want that.
And no cyclists and no people walking around, no kids on bicycles.
I think it's actually a potentially positive vision. So that would mean you would have fence off the streets. There would be robo-taxis circling around. And then maybe bicycle highways and pedestrian parts. And the robo-taxis could pick you up anywhere and bring you to public transport. That is not the Californian vision, but it could be our European vision. It would solve one problem that level 5 cars don't solve, namely the cities would no longer be congested with parking cars because nobody owns a car anymore.
So as you can see, it requires both correct vision and correct implementation of the vision. So there are many challenges ahead.
Yeah, and the challenges are not only technically in nature, but they are also about society, power in society, right. Autonomy. Yeah. And so it means developing smart machines means looking closer to humans and their world and their dreams. I always think that since 2,500 years, people are dreaming robots doing the dirty and boring and hard work, and now we come closer and closer to realizing this vision, and then we see which questions need to be answered, and maybe that was never clear how many problems come with this idea, and yeah, maybe it's really a question of adaptation. How far are we willing to adapt ourselves to a world where robots which are not that intelligent can function in a robust way? Yeah,
that's exactly the question.
It's also the intent, right? What do you intend for these robots to do, and what are you trying to get from it? And the reason there is all these big companies and stuff pushing one way is their intent is clear. It's their profit margin, right? So if you want the artificial systems to help society, then you have to think with that intent and make changes accordingly.
Not only about substitution of human workforce.
That is the key problem, huh? That it's so much money driven and not necessarily for the best of us.
Yeah. But your group will, of course, help us to understand ourselves and our heuristics and our kind of decision-making better, so that we hopefully...
For answers to all these questions, come to our groups.
At least robust decision heuristics where to use which robots.
I want to say one thing, which is humans are so much more intelligent than AI that we have currently in so many ways. So sometimes it's easy to be impressed by AI because they can do this, they can do that, they win competitions. But still, if you look at the whole, a human being is so much more intelligent than what we can do with AI, if you look at the whole. And there's still a lot we can learn from humans.
Mm-hmm. Of course, it's a general, so to say, a general intelligence and not a specialist on statistics or
exactly
one tiny...
It depends on how you characterize that, right? Like, you know, it's not just, I mean, just to build on that, like, you know, often when people say intelligence, it's intelligent because it plays a game. It's intelligent because it's able to transfer knowledge from one game to the other game. So I think what we should marvel at is the sort of the plasticity, the adaptability, the learning abilities that humans bring. And that is across different things. Even if you know nothing about it, you can still have some innate skills that you can take elsewhere, right? Mm-hmm. So those kind of things, it would be marvelous. We are far away from doing that with any state-of-the-art modern system. Right? All the impressive stuff that they show you, it's good, and we see them, and they are very useful, but still, they don't have the kind of capabilities that Oscar is referring to, that humans have. As imperfect as we all are, we still are better than the state-of-the-art systems, much, much better.
And that's also what amazes me. The talk in the media is about, AI will get so much more better. Almost nobody talks how to make humans smarter. And that is something disappointing. Yeah. And the human mind is not just a much more generalist. We are also energy efficient. The human mind...
10 watts of power.
20 watts, it's... can do amazing thing. And recently in the news was that the city of Frankfurt, about 40% of the energy is consumed by the computing centers.
We are also data efficient. So these large language systems, they're trained on all of the words we have ever written in the history of the humankind, right? That is still available to us. That is not sample efficient.
None of us train on the entire data set either.
Yeah, so we are data efficient, and the current AI systems are not.
And maybe one last point, I'm sorry, is that the claim that is made is these huge systems are generative, that they understand the processes and therefore we should do them. And that's nothing could be further from the truth in some senses. Like, you know, that's not what they are. Right? They don't understand the underlying principles. But many people who talk about it or understand, talk about the capabilities often do not understand what is the basic principles driving it. And even when they do, like from these big tech companies or other people, experts, they don't seem to realize that these terms that they are using, like generative or foundational, these are older terms in AI. And there are other systems, like humans. We are truly generative systems. We understand processes. We transfer skills, and we are able to do those things. But these large language models or these ChatGPTs or whatever, they don't have those capabilities that are there, that are often touted as their capabilities mm-hmm. in media.
And with the capabilities they have, they force us to think more closely about the concepts we use, about what intelligence is, about what understanding means exactly. And I think we are used to have these words for humans, and they fit so more or less for animals, but for robots and for artificial intelligence systems, it becomes very difficult to say exactly what you mean by intelligence, by understanding, by creativity, and by all those things. And maybe they at least force us to think more clearly about ourselves and our concepts, and help us to understand intelligence better. So thank you very much. We could continue for hours. I think it's such a great topic. So maybe is there anything listeners could read or where they could follow up on this topic if they are interested? I mean, we could also add hints later in the show notes, but if you know something you would recommend for interested people to follow up on these topics? Is there any book or podcast or whatever comes to your mind?
There is a book by Konstantinos Katsikopoulos, Oskar Simsek, Markus Buchmann, and myself, called Categorization in the Wild, that teaches how to construct heuristics. And there's another book that I have written that's in the English version is called How to Stay Smart in a Smart World. It's Penguin. And Mohan, what would you recommend?
What would I recommend? So I think this is a bit harder to say in the broader robotics AI world, is that, and this is the reason why one of the chapters that we want to write in the book is the hidden use of heuristics, right? Because they're used extensively, like the examples that Gerd said before. And that's been a really fun part for me, like, you know, this discussion is as I talk to them and they say, oh, this is this. And then I go, oh, yeah, this is how it is used. Like, you know, we use them. We just don't call them that there. So there is no clear documentation that I can point to, right, that I can say, okay, this documents all the use of the decision heuristics in, say, in robotics, for instance. I can't do that. But I will say that this is the first meeting that we are having. And if you give us a little more time, maybe in the next year or so, we will give you the book that or the papers that you should look at. So I'll say, watch this space, as they say in some places. Like, you know, and that's what I'm going to stop with. Yeah.
That's a perfect point. And we wish you all the best for the future of this research group. And we are very much looking forward to your group coming back to CIF and all your discussions and, of course, finally, the book you're working on. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Welcome.
And
thank you.
Thank you. It's our pleasure.